Hey, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Youngelman. This episode is brought to you by Microseed, the Bitcoin self-custody maximalist. Stamp your 12 or 24 word seed phrase on titanium the size of a quarter. Discreet, resilient, seed security made simple. Make sure to use the code MATRIX for a discount at microseed.io. If you haven't tried Peony Lane wines yet, what are you even doing with your life? The Pinot Noir is my favorite. Thank you, Ben Justman, for creating your beautiful wines. Get yours now just in time for the holidays. In this episode, I had the pleasure of joining Robin Sayer on his show to dive deep into Bitcoin, its current trajectory, and the bigger forces shaping our future. Robin and I unpack everything from Bitcoin treasury companies and ETFs to price discovery, passive investing, and what it really means for Bitcoin adoption. We touch on how governments might try to co-opt Bitcoin, the role of stablecoins, and whether Bitcoin is ultimately a lifeboat away from fiat collapse. If you're curious about where Bitcoin stands today, how it could evolve tomorrow, and what we could do as individuals to preserve its core ethos, this rip is for you. If you want to get in touch with me, it's cedric@thebitcoinmatrix.com, where we also have our new merch store. Head over there to get your Bitcoin Against the Machine, Cash is Trash, and Bitcoin Matrix logo t-shirts. If you want to help support me and the show directly, I've added links for Venmo, PayPal, Bitcoin with Strike, and a P.O. box so you can send a check or money order, value for value style. I really appreciate your past, current, and future contributions. They mean the world to me and help make the show sustainable. Also, if you could leave a 5-star review and share your favorite Bitcoin Matrix episodes with your friends and family, this would really help us get the word out. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with me, interviewed by Robin Sayer.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Maybe you can give us some brief overview of who you are and especially why you're excited about Bitcoin.
Sure. My name is Cedric Youngelman. I'm the host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast and Bitcoin Center. I'm co-host of Bitcoin Center with Paul Tarantino. That's live Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. And why am I excited about Bitcoin? Well, I'm excited about separating money from state from money. I think that's been a terrible combination for most citizens around the world. And I think it's also the best way to have something that can't be debased. And it's a great anchor for, I think, you know, people to think about how to protect their wealth, you know, or life raft, if you will. So quickly, that's some of the reasons I'm excited about Bitcoin. I think it's the most important thing in the world. So
it's,
I think
it's interesting. Because you said in the beginning, before we started recording, that you're kind of annoyed on this like Bitcoin treasury companies, because I think that's exactly the reason where I feel like it's a distraction, because there's all those things why we're excited about Bitcoin and why we got into Bitcoin. Maybe not like if I'm totally honest, I got into Bitcoin because of the gains, but I stayed and then got deep into Bitcoin because of exactly the reasons that you lined out. So I feel like there is a big value to just like the number go up technology. But I hear you a lot with being like kind of annoyed at this distraction of the Bitcoin treasury companies. And when you said like you're excited about this, and like I thought about Bitcoin treasury companies, kind of a distraction to that.
It's a major distraction. I'm excited about them from a finance and economics perspective, and how they're going to hopefully eat traditional finance. But I think it's a distraction from all the things that make Bitcoin Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin treasury companies, they centralize their Bitcoin. You're not holding the Bitcoin. You don't have any real true claim on it other than as a shareholder and you're last in line. It's not about self-custody. It's not about using Bitcoin as a currency or a medium exchange. It's not about improving Bitcoin's privacy or, you know, personal security, or just even, you know, layer one security. So I think it's a big distraction from the bigger issues in Bitcoin. And I think it's also potentially a great way for the state to capture Bitcoin, I guess in quotes, you know, or literally seize Bitcoin, confiscate Bitcoin in the future. So, while I think it's exciting from the financialization of Bitcoin, I wish those other topics wouldn't be so suffocated in this environment. And I think it also brings a lot of people to Bitcoin. It's great. Bitcoin's for everyone. But it brings a lot of people, I think, to Bitcoin who really see it as a get rich quick scheme and something they could trade and flip, you know? So in that regard, you know, it's not really, it's any education, you know, there's like, there's no bad publicity, but you know, I don't think it's the best necessarily like on ramp for Bitcoin education.
Yeah, there's this thing where everything is good for Bitcoin, but also even Satoshi was very concerned about how we grow this thing, and he was cautious about not making it too big too fast because it can be captured. And I'm kind of wondering, because I do see the positive and the negative side of treasury companies, and I think it's kind of coming anyway, so like we can comment on it, but it will come, like they are coming faster and faster in there, and it will happen anyways. But I do wonder if the value they bring and the service they bring, and they do bring a lot of service with unlocking capital that wouldn't otherwise be impossible to get into Bitcoin, and the financialization that you brought in, if this makes up for the negative aspects of decentralizing coins possibly being a target for 6102 and all the things that you've mentioned, like this balancing of we want Bitcoin to go up and be financialized, but also we want to have this core ethos in Bitcoin maintained. And I don't know, like, Do we succeed if Bitcoin is just mainstream money, and along the way we might lose some of the core ethos? I don't know.
Yeah, we might. I mean, I think Bitcoin treasury companies are an evolving financial mechanism, and I think at some point you reach a nexus where operating companies that have positive cash flow take on that strategy. And it just eats the Bitcoin treasury companies. Maybe only a few survive in that regard. I do think it unlocks capital. I personally understand that at a very personal level with whatever money I had trapped in 401ks and Roths here in the US. And you know, someone who works and saves and, you know, receives company matches. I had a small pool of capital in my 401k, and I think I had an IRA. And yeah, there were things like GBTC that I looked at as how can I, you know, get Bitcoin price exposure with this trapped capital. It worked for me. I can understand why Metaplanet's having success in Japan, SmarterWeb's trying to do it in UK. I do question, though, how much capital in this, how much money coming into these Bitcoin treasury companies is actually trapped capital versus retail excitement that's not necessarily trapped. And I would also encourage people to think about, you know, if you, let's say you had some trapped capital, you have $10,000 in your IRA and you've done phenomenally well, you've done a 10, 20, 50, 100X with any of these securities. It's okay, I think, to thank those securities and pull your money, maybe even pay penalties to get your trapped capital out of the system entirely. Or there are new products that have come along. The ETFs are here. And again, that's not Bitcoin ethos, but you could use ETFs. And you could also do self-custody in a lot of these vehicles now, especially in the United States. And Trump just did an executive order to increase the ability to buy Bitcoin in your 401k. So I think in the States, it's just your IRA. So I really see that use case. I just think right now, a lot of the fervor in this market is retail, FOMO, and not necessarily 100% trapped capital. And trapped capital sometimes gets unleashed. You know, Japan can change their rules around spot Bitcoin and how it's treated from a tax perspective. And that reduces, you know, the moat of a company like Metaplanet. So
Yeah, it's a great question. Sorry for the ramble.
Is besides the narrative and besides maybe getting some retail folks excited about a treasury company and not Bitcoin itself, do Bitcoin treasury companies and the institutions and companies in general that they're coming more and more into Bitcoin change something like maybe the cycles, maybe like the buying behavior, or maybe whatever you want to take it?
Yeah, I think the ETFs combined with the Bitcoin treasury companies have definitely altered or are altering the cycles. ETFs are some of the people who are buying the ETF, the Bitcoin ETFs right now, are some of the smartest value investors in traditional finance. And those are strong hands, generally speaking. And we've seen this over the last, I think, year plus. Every dip is getting sort of bought up rather quickly. We're not having large spikes up. We're going sideways for a long time, minor dips, bought up right away, and moving up levels like a step ladder. So it seems like Bitcoin's it's maturing, it seems like, as an asset class. That doesn't preclude me from thinking that it can get much more volatile going forward still, and volatility can come back. But I do think that we'll see, my hypothesis, we'll see probably smaller drawdowns than historically speaking. You know, you have to really think about already 90% plus of Bitcoin has been issued. So how much does the halvings really matter, you know, going forward? Are they going to have the same sort of jolt on you know, humanity when you're at 94.5% Bitcoin already emitted, and more Bitcoin is getting bought per day than is produced through mining, through these treasury companies? And that'll be interesting. I do also think, though, the ETFs bring probably like this. I think we have less true price discovery. So, you know, the security markets are incredibly centralized. You can note BlackRock and Vanguard, and yeah, they're acting on behalf of their customers and they own those assets on behalf of those customers, but they know all the deal flow on probably 60 to 75% of the market because they manage the deal flow of their customers. And then the DTCC clears like 99.99% of all securities, bonds, and all financial instruments, derivatives in almost the globe, I think, you know, definitely in America. I feel like there's a lot of, I don't think there's true price discovery in any of these markets anymore for so many different reasons, from passive investors who never turn off the, you know, the buying on a monthly, or weekly, or bi-monthly basis. So I do think there's potential, or that we just haven't seen true price discovery. But at the same time, I do think it supports, you know, the floor, the price floor. So I don't know. This is very it's interesting to watch. I mean, do you think the Bitcoin treasury companies alter the cycles?
When it comes to Bitcoin, the rules are simple: run your own node, hold your own keys, and protect your seed phrase. That's where Microseed comes in. Unlike bulky backups, Microseed is stamped onto a tiny steel washer. Fireproof, waterproof, and so small you can carry it anywhere or hide it in plain sight. Go to microseed.io and use the code MATRIX for a discount on your order.
I think price and supply and demand usually alters the cycles, and as the supply stays the same and the demand changes, the cyclical nature of Bitcoin might actually change. But I'm really interested because you said like less price discovery. Do you mean because people are just in those passive instruments, and then they just invest in like a fund, and then it just gets passively invested in like a little bit Bitcoin, a little bit stocks, a little bit here and there, and basically people don't really pick themselves, and they just let a management or like an automatic thing do it? Or do you talk more about paper Bitcoin and the IOUs things?
I think more of the first. And so I think passive investors, you know, imagine going to the supermarket and you want to buy, you bought tomatoes last week, 3 for $1, and you want to buy them again today, this week, you're going to make a salad. And now they're, you know, $4 each. And you might think to yourself, hey, maybe I'm not going to go buy 3 tomatoes for $12 now. Things have changed. I'm going to buy cucumbers. I'll buy croutons. I'll buy red peppers. I'll change it up. But if you're, you know, sort of a 401k investor, you're buying on an algorithmic basis whenever you're stacking, and you're buying generally like, so you're saying, okay, I want to buy Microsoft this week. I don't care what the price is. I'm going to buy, I'm going to rebalance it to Microsoft. I'm going to buy Amazon. I'm going to buy Google. I'm going to buy the Mag 7, regardless of price. So passive investors are not looking at value investing or trying to see, hey, you know, this stock has gone up a lot since last week. Maybe I should buy more of this other stock that I have a lot of faith in that hasn't gone up. And generally speaking, passive investors, you sort of, you cut your flowers and you water your weeds. Generally speaking, you know, you rebalance out of the winners and into your losers. And so I think that leads to higher floors, less price discovery on the downside. You kind of see this with like NVIDIA or Amazon. Like anytime bad news comes out, there might be a small dip, and then the stock recovers and goes to new highs. There's no real price discovery on the downside right now. There's not a lot of short sellers in any of these markets who are challenging and pushing and, you know, pushing back on valuation models. There's very little value investors who are doing well right now. And I think a lot of that's driven by passive investing. And in essence, a lot of that is really not doing like true mark to market valuations. So, you know, everyone thinks, you know, like, I mean, NVIDIA is trading at what, 50 PE right now, right? It's a $4 trillion ass stock. So everyone, there's a lot of people who think they're worth that much money. And if those bubbles pop or burst or come back to any sort of mean or medium historically, a lot of people are going to have less money than they thought they did. I don't know. I kind of went on a tangent there, but, I think that, you know, having all the centralized forces in these markets leads to more, I wouldn't say price fixing or, you know, or anything, illegal, but more price coordination, more collusion, more aligned interests. Just in terms of the ETF, you're not going from even cash to Bitcoin. You're going from, generally speaking, in the system, the authorized participants are trading in and out of the ETF with cash. So it's not even in-kind exchanges. That just got approved. So I think there's that leads to more fees, more middlemen, which leads to, think about it, if you're buying $100 of Bitcoin and there's 2% of fees, so every $100 you want to put into Bitcoin, $2 goes into fees. That's less money going into the asset. I don't know. And I think that it seems like most parties that are the biggest supporters of Bitcoin right now, like let's say the U.S. government, is really embracing Bitcoin, which is strange if you really boil it down. But it seems like everyone's really excited about it because that means I think everyone thinks, when governments get involved, these treasury companies get involved, that's people going to buy their bags, right? Make them rich. Oh, I forgot where I was going with that. But I'm sorry.
It's fascinating because I never thought about passive investment like ETFs and all those instruments. Like if you think about from first principles, like fiat came around and fiat pushed people to all sorts of financial instruments for savings because fiat is horrible in saving money, obviously. And so a lot of my friends, they have ETFs, they usually have ETFs actually as savings. Rarely people have something else outside of that. They usually have like a bank consultant, they're like, hey, like there's this XYZ ETF, you want to be more aggressive, you want to be more economic friendly, you want to like all those weird ETFs, they all have kind of the same thing, but they have a different name, a different label on them. And then they all invest in that just because the bank consultant told them to, and they trust the banks. And literally today, there's an Austrian study coming up, came out how many people are trusting in the government institutions. And it was a high number. It was like in the 90s where people were saying like, yeah, I trust the banks, I trust the government, I trust the police and execution, which is generally a good thing for a state to have. Like, it means like the state is working fine. And I think like Austria still works okay-ish. I am not a fan of the EU, but like Austrian government does not do complete BS, but there's another tangent. But when we have that situation, and before you told me, I never thought about that, we have a lot of people that just invest in this instruments and leave it there, and there's rebalancing going on. There's nobody that really says like, oh, like this is a good thing, and especially it's not your own money, you invest other people's money, and like with other people's money you don't care that much as with your own money. This distorts the price and the price discovery. That I literally never thought about that, and it's so obvious once you see it, because like the fiat itself distorts the price signal, but fiat and the second implications with financial instruments like ETFs distorting the price massively. I'm like almost 600 episodes in, and it's the first time I thought about ETFs kind of destroying the price discovery of a free market, and kind of is a tool against the free market just because people use it really weirdly and as a savings vehicle, and they just put the money in there, and no matter what, that's really interesting.
Flows, just all algorithmically being sold or bought, you know. And I think a lot about my recent conversation with Dave Colum and his tweets, and he's really speaking to sort of the value in the market. It just seems like it's 200% overvalued, like stocks, and real estate seems incredibly overvalued, and so you could talk about all the reasons why it's overvalued, but at some point it returns to the mean. At some point, you know, stocks aren't going to be 50 PE. He talked about how if you ask the average investor like what they expect out of their portfolio, they're expecting sort of like 10 to 12% returns above inflation. But if you're buying a stock at 50 PE, that's a 2% return. And there's a major disconnect there. And then the other thing I'm tying into all this is like, I think it's possible AI is completely overvalued and not going to deliver the growth that they want to see in the economy. And it's possible that it's actually going to be deflationary. People will lose jobs. There won't be as many new jobs maybe or new whatever. So let's say it's deflationary. And if people want to like, obviously they want to, I think, kind of contain sort of that whole narrative in NVIDIA and the Mag 7. And if this bubble pops, they're praying that people only sell their Mag 7. But right now, through the things like ETFs and funds, you could just sell the whole thing with one push of a button. And that will be interesting, you know, in a digital era when we ever get into real price discovery on the downside. I think the other thing right now that's good, it's just interesting how much lack of exuberance there is for Bitcoin this price point in US dollar terms.
I do think so too. I get messages, and I just talked about it with Sean in the morning, where we talked about we are up 87% the last time I looked with the Bitcoin price in the last 12 months, and people act like we are down 50. we are in a massive bear market since 2 years, but we actually are in a bull market. We are 87% up. Yes, we are not 200%, 300%, 400% up in the last 2 weeks. But Bitcoin kind of changed. And as we said before, we went from like, I don't know, a jet ski to like a small speedboat to now maybe we are slowly coming to being an aircraft carrier. And at some point we will be a freaking island. It's like, so like we are growing and then Bitcoin, it needs a lot of people have this price targets of, I don't know what, if you have price targets, but like have this price targets of like 500,000, 1,000,000, 2,000,000. And I'm like, you know how much money has to go in there to reach those price targets, and what has to happen in order to go there. And I'm not saying it's impossible. This year on this cycle, we will definitely hit it at some point. But people say like, oh, like 1,000,000 this year, 1,000,000 next year. I don't wish that for anyone because I think this shows that the fiat system is kind of completely bust, and there's friends and families that you still have to save here.
Well, that's what Michael Novogratz mentioned the other day, and maybe you agree with him. Is like, if Bitcoin went to 1,000,000 this year, which I think is still possible, not maybe likely or probable, you know, how bad would that be for, you know, let's say the economy? And what does that mean for the price of different things? But maybe, you know, the price of bread doesn't skyrocket in that example. And maybe that's a way to export all the inflation into Bitcoin. And I do also think at some point, like we kind of have to rip the Band-Aid off. Like even if we don't want it to go quick, we don't want it to be ugly. I don't think we have a choice. I think idealistically, the longer this takes, the slower the grind up, the better for everybody. But I don't think we're assured that by any means. And I think at some point we have to deal with this, the pain in the system or how broken it is.
There's two interesting theories, and I'm really curious on what you think, because I'm not 100% sure on like what I really am fixed on. The first theory, and this is what I always kind of pushed on, but I'm not sure if it's the right one, is that we are on the Titanic with fiat, and we should sink the Titanic as slow as possible to get everyone safe to the Bitcoin land. This makes sense because like the Titanic, if it sinks slowly, we have enough chance to actually get the people out and get them safe, and they are not wet and they are not sinking in the water. But then there's also the other theory, and it's the other kind of like thought experiment. What if fiat is an addiction, a drug addiction, and we are now saying, oh, let's take fiat still, but let's take it a little less. So it's like, oh, let's still take heroin, but let's take a little less. And as you said, maybe we have to rip off the Band-Aid. Maybe we have to just stop taking the drugs. Maybe we have to just stop taking the addiction that we are in and just get clean and get to a Bitcoin system. And also with drug addicts, like if you completely cut them, like there's usually a crash happening. Like I'm not super into this topic, but I can imagine things like that happening. So Bitcoin will do what Bitcoin will do, and we will see how it progresses. I just think if Bitcoin goes up too quickly and then in the same time fiat goes down too fast, there might be bad things happening along the way. But either way, we will come to a nice Bitcoin land. So I just don't think like... like the slower it goes, like for me, it's the better. But I'm not certain about that. If we see fiat as the poison, maybe we have to get the poison out of the system faster. I'm not fully sure on that.
I look at the United States government. Maybe this is where I was going with it. The United States government is embracing Bitcoin, and a lot of governments are looking at Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, from my perspective, is discovered and utilized to separate money from state. But what if the state, and my good friend Paul Tarantino talks about this, what if the state kind of mapped out and gamed out their debt problem with fiat and came up with the answer? And the answer is you need a heat sink like Bitcoin, like gold, like oil. So I'm also reading Mark Goodwin's book, The Bitcoin Dollar, and I'm trying to understand this. if you can yoke the dollar to one of these asset classes like gold originally and then oil, and you always keep, you keep medium exchange out of it and you keep unit of account out of it, so you don't care if the dollar store value, you just need it to be a medium exchange. Means you need to buy, if you want to buy that thing, you have to use dollars. And you want to keep unit of account. So if you want to measure that thing, you measure it in dollars. And therefore, then the wealth in the world stays in dollars. Everything is measured in dollars. And I think this is what Jeff Booth talks about. So Bitcoin fails as a medium exchange. It fails like gold failed. So I think that's why, and again, I look at, you know, Bitcoin is built utilizing SHA-256 technology, which is CIA government technology, and they're embracing it now. And if the way they're embracing it, though, is by herding it all together and ghettoizing it, so making it a stagnant asset, sort of like a pet rock, and if that thing grows in value, they can sell dollars and have everything measured in dollars. So they could sell treasuries to the stable coins. If you want to buy the thing, you got to buy the stable coin. And then, so if you want to buy the stable coin, they got to buy US treasuries. And you have this beautiful mechanism. You actually build a floor into the dollar, because anytime the stable coin breaks peg and goes below, there'll be large institutions and pools of capital that want to buy dollars for less than the price of a dollar. And then you have a valuable dollar if it breaks the peg above. You know, now you could buy more than a dollar for a dollar. So I think that that's sort of the end game, or the way to extend the life of the dollar is the government's going to look to use Bitcoin as a heat sink, the way they used. And so you had the petrodollar, right? After we broke the peg with gold, we had the petrodollar. If you wanted to buy the oil and use energy in the world, you had to go with dollars. Even if both parties didn't trade in dollars in their home currency, you know, they have native currencies, they had to use dollars as an intermediary to buy oil. And oil is priced in dollars. And, I think a lot about that convergence. And alongside the Bitcoin treasuries companies, which is a centralizing force, and sort of the lack of interest in sort of the other qualities of Bitcoin.
It's super interesting. And I like, I'm big on there's like the Bitcoin system and the fiat system, and you can hold Bitcoin in the fiat system. And if I do not hope that for anyone, but it's a possibility that if you hold Bitcoin in the fiat system, which an ETF is, or like in a treasury company, or like on exchange even, you might end up with zero Bitcoin. Like I do not hope that for anyone. Like I do hope that your IOU is actually holding up and you get your Bitcoin at some point in kind. But it's just a reality that those are not really your Bitcoin, and they're in the fiat system, and you might end up with zero Bitcoin because it's just a piece of paper that you in the end have. That's why, as long as we can push self-custody and maybe even like spending a Bitcoin and kind of trying to have more and more Bitcoin ecosystems and full node operators and all those things out there, I think as long as we have that, we are good, and only individuals that hold it in the fiat system will suffer from that.
Yeah, I think about this a lot too, and I have sort of mixed feelings. On one hand, you have to have your Bitcoin in self-custody to get the qualities and the good stuff from Bitcoin, but you become your own counterparty risk to yourself and to anyone else in your life that you want to inherit your Bitcoin or get access to your Bitcoin in case anything happened to you. But for thousands of years or hundreds of years, people have trusted institutions with their wealth. You've never been able to like take full self-custody of this kind of wealth before. I mean, and you think about how like why necklaces were created, so that you didn't hide your money under a mattress. You put your shells on your neck. So if someone wants to steal your money in the middle of the night, they had to wake you up to take it off your neck. It wasn't to show off the money. It was to protect the money, to keep it on you, to have self-custody of your shells. But at some point, you know, you look at rhinestones, And the biggest rhinestones in the village were kept in the middle of the village because it was an honest, transparent ledger. People knew who worked or owned that particular stone. And even if you stole it, the idea of the value behind the stone and who it should accrue to was still in everyone's ledger because it was a small enough economy where they could kind of keep track of those things. But trust is in the system. And my guess is if Bitcoin overtakes the entire economy and becomes all three things, store of value, medium exchange, and unit of account, I do think a lot of people and institutions and entities would probably have not take self-custody of their Bitcoin. And I don't think that would be the worst thing in the world. You know, I think a lot of people would look at it and say, hey, how much of my stack do I have to have in self-custody for various reasons? And what rights and access do I have to have to the other part of the stack to move it into my getaway stack if I needed to change my threat vector? Right? Like, I mean, like Joe Rogan doesn't keep all his wealth at his crib. You know, he's a very wealthy person. People know he's wealthy. You know, even though he doesn't keep it there, you know, he still hires bodyguards, probably in security. I mean, like everyone has to look at their own threat vector. Like I was talking to David Collum last night and, you know, he's like, he would be scared of a wrench attack and he doesn't understand maybe multi-sig and different ways to secure your Bitcoin. But I think if he owned a Bitcoin, I don't think he'd have a problem if he kept it at Fidelity and for him avoided his biggest nightmare, someone coming to his home and trying to take his Bitcoin, you know, or any of his wealth. So I think that will evolve too. And I think the way you self-custody will probably evolve over time. I mean, it's a very nascent technology in that respect, all of this. So in how we look at it, how we interact with it, I mean, like corporations, I mean, they're going to have to really look at how they hold it. Do you have three people five people who have keys and three of them can move the coins? Do you have nine people? Do you have 17? Like, how do you figure this out? Do you keep it at three different custodians and have only certain people who can call the custodian? I mean, how do countries then, you know, buy and store Bitcoin? And that's another thing. I think, you know, a lot of people think the U.S. is going to buy Bitcoin, and I really don't. I don't think the United States government is interested in buying something and never selling it. I don't think they have, like, you'd have to buy Bitcoin and sell it to actually capture gains I just don't see the United States government or really a lot of governments looking to do that in the near term. Especially killing the notion of their own golden goose. You know, the United States government gets to issue $100 bills that cost them 7 cents to produce, right? And like, think about like a supermarket that's operating at like 1 to 2% profit margins. I mean, they're operating at over 99% operating margin or profit margin on their goods. They're not going to let anyone mess with that business.
But maybe they need Bitcoin to prolong this business.
They totally do. They need, if Bitcoin goes up in value, stable coins have to buy more U.S. treasuries. And when a stable coin is issued, the United States government gets a 2-for-1. So they issue the stable coin, that's a dollar, and the stable coin has to go buy a U.S. treasury, which is a second dollar to back the first dollar. So $1 bought, $2 sold. So it's a great business. And I think that's part of the reason the price of Bitcoin is through any, whether it's nefarious or, you know, just again, I think there's a lot of parties involved that are moving a lot of Bitcoin through regulated markets. And I think those parties have an opportunity to work together to push price in different directions, whether it's to burn short sellers or to liquidate longs or, you know, but whatever it might be. I mean, we've seen a lot of manipulation in gold markets. So I think the United States government is trying to roll out the Genius Act and the Big Beautiful Bill and all the regulatory clarity on stable coins and onshore as much stable coins as possible to sell U.S. treasuries and then let the price of Bitcoin potentially rip. Or at least step ladder up a lot more. and issue more treasuries behind all those stablecoins.
I see, like, the same was gold and paper bills were now Bitcoin and stablecoins. So it's like almost a Bretton Woods 2.0, where the US is already saying, like, we want Bitcoin to flourish in America, and we will give the rest of the world stablecoins. It's a genius thing to do.
It's monetary colonialism. I mean, those U.S. dollar stable coins, whatever you want to call them, I think we should call them digital political currency units. But those things will get into markets that the dollar has never been able to get into, like Iran and China and Russia. And it'll help bring and that will be a stepladder improvement for all the economies around the world who are on a crappier coin than the dollar. And I think that's where, you know, you see stable coins as a bridge to Bitcoin. Or an on-ramp, but I think it extends the life of the dollar because it brings that's a much better unit of account for a lot of economies. It's a slower death for a lot of people around the world to be on the dollar than it is to be on their local currency.
And I mean, if you look at Turkey and all those, like, if you have like a inflation rate of like 100 or over 100% a year, like that, like it's not the US dollar is almost like a Bitcoin at that point.
Right. And if you look at Bitcoin treasury companies, I mean, these are right now the companies coming to this strategy are failing companies. You know, Metaplanet, they can't get people, you know, COVID destroyed their hotel business. So how do we change it up? What can we do? We could become a Bitcoin treasury company, right? And that was a lot of external qualities too, beyond just being you're tethering yourself to the Bitcoin price. You get great marketing, you get sort of community support, all these different things. But it's been struggling and failing companies that have come to this game plan first. And the companies that will come last are your most successful companies. They have the least incentive to change what they're doing. And so it's going to be countries that have, you know, that the dollar is taking over their local currency and they don't have a local currency and or they have a failing currency. And these will be the countries that turn to Bitcoin first, like a la El Salvador, right? They didn't have their own currency. They were already dollarized. So they have the least skin in the game in keeping their own currency so they can move to, you know, sort of try to experiment with Bitcoin. And so I think you'll see tiny failing countries try Bitcoin first. And that would be exciting. I would love to see some countries that, you know, really turn everything around for their citizens by jumping on the Bitcoin bandwagon, right? And moving to a Bitcoin standard. I'd love to see a company continue to thrive like what we've seen with El Salvador in a short period of time. And that story remains to be written, but it'll be amazing to see a country rise to the cream of the crop through a Bitcoin standard. But it'll be countries without their own currency, I think, first, or failing currencies.
And I 100% agree. That's why I was so surprised to see a president of the United States talking about Bitcoin, being at Bitcoin conferences, being openly about, oh, maybe we buy some, maybe we do this and that. Like, just the presence of him at a Bitcoin conference, that honestly surprised me, that it felt so out of place. Like, it felt like this should happen in 2035 or 2030 or something like that. For me also, El Salvador felt out of place. Like, El Salvador happened way earlier than I thought it will happen. Like, I came into Bitcoin in 2020 and had my theories of if Bitcoin is successful, how it will go. And I completely underestimated the developments on a nation side of things. I overestimated how quick it will go with companies. Like, I thought we have like 100, 200 companies within like 2022, but we are we're not even at 200 publicly traded companies yet. So it's interesting how countries are already doing that. Like, it's unreal for me.
I put on my tinfoil hat and I wonder if, you know, El Salvador is like a CIA project to test out in a small economy what putting it on Bitcoin standard would look like. And also sort of aligning Bitcoin with sort of a more, you know, people look at things with broad strokes, and it's not that, you know, you could say El Salvador is not a democratic country anymore, And I don't think democracy is necessarily the best thing humanity will ever come up with, but you know, that's used, that's a double-edged sword, right? And I think that, you know, I don't think Trump is an outsider. I do think his family got debanked maybe, but I don't think that they're outside the establishment. He was a prior president already. And I think he was installed to roll out the digital surveillance network. And I think that starts with, you know, paving the way for stable coins. And notice how they put a really broad net on crypto and sort of, and they've sort of sanctioned all like Ripple and ETH are now like sort of legal securities or just kind of gotten backdoored around the Howey test. And all these things should, you know, I hate government intervention, but I do think, you know, if we're going to have a government, they should be intervening in predatory behavior. And I think a lot of these things have been predatory and not in good faith and not, and are kind of registered securities. So, or not unregistered securities. So why is Trump bear hugging Bitcoin? Why were, you know, I think it was great that we had politicians come speak to us, but it felt more like we were at a certain politician's rally rather than they were asked to come and present their ideas to us for us to think through their ideas. And I think we, you know, we might have got a lot of short term gains, and I use we very loosely here. There is no real Bitcoin community. But there, if there is a movement, you know, we've really tethered our movement to one political party. And, you know, political, I think both political parties are used to divide and conquer us. So you could see, you know, what if the Republican Party loses the midterm elections? Then, you know, the other party wants to do a whole bunch of, they want to repeal a lot of EOs and laws and new regulation. I mean, what if we get a different a president from a different party in 3 years? A lot can change. A lot of the things that Trump has done that have been positive for Bitcoin have been done through EO, not through sort of the voting process and, you know, through more mainstream legislation. So those things can change in the headwinds, and you could see how Bitcoin could be a political football, you know, years from now in the United States government. And that this could, you know, humans have been FOMOing in and out of Bitcoin for 16 years now. So you could see how, what if we did go up to like, you know, $1 million by April of next year? And then, you know, things change in the political environment and there's, you know, recession and Bitcoin goes down to back down to 42K. Or 47K, or, you know, and if Bitcoin were to go below 69K, I think that would really put a wrinkle in the narrative of, you know, always having higher lows. So, you know, it's interesting how, you know, how the hand has been played. You know, I would have liked to have seen the Bitcoin community just continue to be sort of like the Orange Party. And, you know, you can come and bend the knee, tell us what you'll do for us, but like we're not necessarily gonna long term put ourselves blindly behind a candidate or a party, you know, or just appeal to one side and not the other. And it's made it a very, you know, with Trump and the meme coins that he launched and some of that bullshit. And, you know, it really hasn't in 2025, outside of the Bitcoin bubble, you still go to like something like family barbecues or Thanksgiving, and there's a lot of people on the left or from the Democratic, whatever you want to call it, like who hear about Bitcoin and are just annoyed right away or have bias against Bitcoiners because of their association with some of these things. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that goes and whether, you know, short-term gains lead to long-term pain there.
Yeah, the association is interesting because people, and I see it in the mainstream media all the time, Bitcoin rised partly because of Trump, and that's the only reason they always mention. Like, I don't know how it is in America, but in the Austrian mainstream news cycle, that's when they represent Bitcoin and they show how Bitcoin was rising. They always say, yeah, because Trump is in office and he's a Bitcoiner. That's why Bitcoin is now on the rise. I don't know. Like there's some truth in that, but you let a lot of truth out.
That doesn't discuss fiat and inflation and any of these things that are truly driving the network effects of Bitcoin. And it turns people off and it helps them sort of, I forget the, just push it aside and the path based on, kill the messenger type stuff.
I also find it interesting how in the EU, they are very open and pushing forward the CBDC. And in America, it's a topic where you're like, there's no CBDC. But at the same time, we have stable coins. And I'm like, maybe the stable coins are just the CBDCs of America with a different label on them. Like they can be controlled. They're digital. Like what's the difference to a CBDC?
Yeah. I mean, this is where I think you really get into debate over definitions around, how involved the central bank is with the coin. But I think of things like PayPal already as like a CBDC, right? They could turn me on. They could turn me off. They can, GoFundMe. They could take all the money away from the Canadian truckers. They could turn your bank account on and off. And they can do this at the individual level. And they could do this at the zip code level. And it's just in the United States, it's just masked behind a private public partnership. So the government doesn't track every word you say. Palantir does. The government didn't turn off your money. Bank of America did. But under whose orders and direction? And I think that's, it's just crazy to me how much, people want to think that Trump and Musk were outsiders. And they were just able to buy Twitter and become president of the United States. And then like Musk is not even a United States citizen. And he's like heading up Doge and access to every computer system in the government. Him and Thiel go back to PayPal. And if you look at the PayPal mafia, I mean, every product they've come out with since PayPal, which was trying to basically be a private Bitcoin, was trying to be a private money. PayPal originally was trying to be a currency. And then they just became rails. To tell me Musk doesn't understand currency is crazy, considering how far back he goes with this thing. And I think his goal with X is to turn it into like a WeChat, where you do everything from book your dentist appointment to pay for the dentist bill, which is just a CBDC right there, when he partners with the government. And every business Musk is in is subsidized by the United States government, from satellites to, I'm blanking here, but like to Tesla. And like people want to say, Musk is a smart guy, and like Tesla's like the stupidest idea ever, the electric cars. I mean, I digress, but I think Trump's been installed to sort of roll out all these things and get people to digest it. I think Biden was put in to like go crazy with the inflation because the right would never accept that at first. And then but they would never accept sort of the infringement on digital rights under a Biden administration. It was the same way like Trump. It was great to roll out COVID and the pandemic during Trump. Because the right would have revolted if the left did that. But if it came from the right, it kind of got through a lot easier. I don't know. I think that's the thing. Like, I think that Bitcoiners are not really thinking about like any threats anymore. Like it almost seems like Bitcoin is like, hey, we won. The state's going to pump our bags. Bitcoin companies are going to, pump the price and we're here, we're in Valhalla. And, Bitcoin was built to be anti-fragile, which means that it's going to get tested over and over and that the tests are going to get bigger and bigger. So I would only imagine something's coming we just can't even imagine or envision that's going to test Bitcoin in a very different way than ever before. And I would imagine the state's behind it.
that's a super interesting thing. Do you, like, how do you, like, what if someone is listening to this, like, what can we do to make sure, like, we have Bitcoin and we have as many freedom rights as possible with Bitcoin?
Do you remember proof of keys, where every, like, January 3rd, Trace Mayer, you know, is proof of keys and won't take their key, you know, their coins off? I mean, I think self-custody is the most important thing to the movement right now. Again, I already said earlier, like, I don't think all coins will be in self-custody in the future. But I think if we want true price discovery, and if humanity wants the qualities of Bitcoin, I think we need to take self-custody of coins, which means people need to be educated. I don't think just because you want to take self-custody doesn't mean you should take 100% self-custody of all your coins right away, or all your sats right away, or, you know, maybe you go to single sig first, maybe then you go to multi-sig, maybe you learn when you're a multi-sig that you think single sig's better. I mean, there's so much learning here. And then I think circular economies, people actually using Bitcoin as a medium exchange. And obviously the biggest obstacle there is the taxation of capital gains on Bitcoin transactions, which is if the United States government truly liked Bitcoin and loved Bitcoin, they would treat it as nice as the dollar. They would treat it like money. But you notice they haven't repealed any, or you're taxed on any time you spend your Bitcoin in America if there's capital gains. That would be the best thing the United States government could do for Bitcoin. And
I think the idea of removing capital gains tax for Bitcoin transactions, if they're used to buy something like a product or service, that would be amazing. Like, I already spent my Bitcoin. I earn most of my money directly in Bitcoin, and I spend whatever I can. I have a freelancer that works fully on Bitcoin. I work on the second one. We're doing more and more there. So it's, I love having a cash flow directly in Bitcoin that doesn't even touch fiat. Like, the more I can get there, the happier, the more freaked I am. Like, that's really cool. I do dislike banks a lot and what they're charging and what they're doing and all of those things. So I do like that we have that Bitcoin option and Bitcoin as a medium exchange. I thought they talked about like some $600 lift on transaction in the US. I have no clue what the
state. None of that passed. I don't think any of that passed. There was a lot of talk. I think a lot of the political rhetoric around Bitcoin the last year or two has been a grift, a fundraising grift. Nothing other than Ross getting released. I mean, not a lot is, and repeal, you know, look, a lot has happened. I don't want to gloss over things. But I think, you know, in terms of campaigning on the United States government buying Bitcoin, a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I think a lot of that has been a great way to raise money from Bitcoiners and the greater community of crypto and deliver on the crypto side and not a lot on the Bitcoin side. And I think that, you know, price going up is great, but Bitcoiners, like, you know, buying Bitcoin because treasury companies are buying Bitcoin, or buying Bitcoin because governments might buy Bitcoin, it should be cherries on top. Like, Bitcoin should be enough. Like, you don't need yield on your Bitcoin. You don't need governments to buy your bags. Like, if you're thinking long term that this is truly savings, you're not even planning on selling. Just continue to accumulate whatever you can. And stack. I don't think we're gonna, I mean, even Bo Hines, he just left after 7 months with the government. And like, what was and he went to Tether again, which indicates where this is going. I mean, he didn't even go to like a river or a swan. I mean, he went to a stablecoin company. And he was one of the people were most excited about being in the government.
There's a lot of stablecoin talk, yeah. I mean, there's all, even like at the last Bitcoin conference,
it was all stablecoins.
This remix of stablecoins was really fun. There's like never heard so many times the talks about stablecoins, which is kind of interesting because we I think as Bitcoiners, we have to stay vigilant. We have to stay active and be aware of things. And people got something from this podcast. I do enjoy it a lot. I learned about the necklace thing. That was new for me. This was a small nugget in there. Like I wasn't aware like how necklace came to be. But the theory makes a lot of sense. I have to go deeper on that. That's really cool. I have one question for each and every one of my returning guests. And the question is, what have you learned outside of Bitcoin since your last appearance?
How to take care of an RV. I'm in an RV now. And so I'm learning a whole new set of skills. They're kind of like, it's kind of like taking care of a house. I mean, but there's just a few other things that that you got to do around this thing. And that's what I've been putting my brain power into. Yeah, this RV. What have I learned? Oh, man. I've learned my kids are smarter than me. And that I can't that's learn what they're experience. Learning. Yeah, it's wild, but they're intimidating now. So they're turning 13 and 9. So each birthday is coming up. So yeah, my son, he's like a young man. And if I need to know anything, I just either Google it or ask him. Oh, he'll tell me the answers. He'll interpret it better and explain it to me better than Google will.
When it comes to Bitcoin, the rules are simple. Run your own node, hold your own keys, and protect your seed phrase. That's where Microseed comes in. Unlike bulky backups, Microseed is stamped onto a tiny steel washer. Fireproof, waterproof, and so small you can carry it anywhere or hide it in plain sight. Go to microseed.io and use the code MATRIX for a discount on your order.
Really cool. We have Andrew Teen in the podcast where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest, as you know, and the last guest asks you without knowing who the next guest is. And the last guest asks you, what changed Bitcoin for you?
What changed Bitcoin for me? Like, meaning like what made me get it?
Maybe poorly formulated, but like what did change for you because of Bitcoin?
It's lack of nihilism, having no faith in the future. I got a lot more faith in my ability to steer and create my own future and take it back. As a kid, I always felt like I could create my own future. And then in adulthood, it started that feeling started to wane. And I didn't realize that it was inflation that was just taking so much from me and making it so hard for me to keep up and get ahead and do all the things I wanted to do for my family. So it gave me the ability to almost like stop and smell the roses, you know. You know, so much of, you know, we talk about Bitcoin being time, but when you don't have a lot of time or you're, let's say you're working a lot of hours or something, you start to outsource certain things to get by. And I found a lot of things I was outsourcing to kind of focus on my fiat job. I wanted to do myself, like parenting. You know, I wanted more time to be there with my kids and parent. I don't know. It's a hard thing to explain, but
it's an interesting thing of like outsourcing parenting while you want to do parenting and then you go to the fiat job. And most people do that, you know, like that's how homeschooling is very popular in the Bitcoin ecosystem, but not that popular in the general population.
Yeah. And, or even just taking care of this trailer. Like I want to do these things myself. And before Bitcoin, I never felt like I had the time and that I always had to like go fiat mine and that I just pay someone else to do that. If it costs me less than what I make per hour or something, you know, my fiat job. And I lost a lot of skills doing that. And I think the pleasure of doing things yourself. I don't know. Yeah, I think it just kind of made me more in control of my time, understand the value of my time or not storing it in something that can be taken from me like the dollar or the what I'm trying to store in there. So yeah, just a lot of trying to understand time and how to choose how to spend your time. You know, what does it mean to have free time? You know, so many people are just like, I don't have free time. I don't have time to do anything, you know? And what if you do have time? What do you want to do? And then sometimes you have to do, even if you have, that's interesting. It's like, I do chores, you do chores, and I do that in my free time. Is that free time? Yeah, you know, if you choose to do the chore during your free time, or is that a, and so how, that's perspective, right, too. Why do I have to look at this as not my free time? This is all of this is my free time, you know? And then just also like things like attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you think about something like just the notion of cost of living. Like, oh, you're gonna have another kid. Like, wow. Like, can you afford that? You know? And it's like, you're putting a price tag on life, you know? Like, it's a weird thing. Like, you know, I was coming home from work the other day, and there was, as a DJ on the radio, I like her, but I don't like everything she says. Seems like a lot of propaganda. And it was, she was talking about my Mother's Day, and she was like, you know, there's a survey that came out or a study that mothers make $160,000 a year if they got paid for what they do. So make sure your family appreciates you. And now you're putting a price tag on motherhood, right? And you're also like pitting the mother versus the father in this weird way, because maybe the father doesn't make, I don't know where they get this number where motherhood's worth $160,000. Cause now that's assuming that you get, if you get paid to be a mother, that you get paid 365 days, 24 hours a day, or is it 9 hours a day? Like, how does this work? And now you're saying like, oh, like, honey, you should give me, like, it just really like puts all this price tag and this notion that life costs money. Like, you know, I have deer sometimes in my woods, they're behind my house. Like, I'm sure they're not sitting there like, should we have another baby? Like, will that cost us money? Like, you know, they just figure out like what we need to do to live and eat and sleep. And so you see how it disconnects us from just like being alive, this whole notion of how much things cost. I'm not saying money's not useful, but just around like the way they've financialized every aspect of living.
It's and putting a price tag on motherhood, that's an impossible job to do. Like that, that seems like, oh yeah, like
it seems anti-family.
It's anti-family. Yeah, like what was it worth that my mother raised me? Like everything.
Or how much should she have paid if that was a job that paid? You know, and then making that part of the economic conversation in a household. And yeah, I don't know.
I agree with you, man. That makes a whole lot of sense. And it sounds like a very healthy attitude, and it's a very Bitcoin attitude I hear. That's really cool. Before I let you go, where can people find you and ask you questions?
They can find me on X or Twitter at Sed Youngelman, C-E-D. Youngelman. I host the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. We drop a show weekly, a philosophical podcast about Bitcoin's effects on society, culture, and economics. That's at X_ Bitcoin Matrix, and now Bitcoin Center, Bitcoin_Center, live Tuesdays at 8 p.m.
That sounds very well trained.
Oh, man, I never get that right. Trying. You got to promote yourself in this space. You know, I'm not good at that. I'm working on that. So yeah, check it out and hit me up on X. My DMs are open.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cedric, for being on. And also thank you so much for everyone that is watching and listening, for joining us today, as always.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.